I received 11 Academy Award nominations. I found this clip that I wanted to show, but I hadn't seen the movie yet. The movie's actually still in the theater, so I went to see the movie this week. And unfortunately, the conclusion of the movie is one that's not particularly friendly to authentic faith, I don't think, but the clip is very powerful, and the movie itself is visually stunning and beautiful. The movie's about a young Indian boy named Pai who is stranded on a lifeboat after a shipwreck with some unusual companions and ends up being there alone with a Bengal tiger. So we're going to watch this clip that gives a little bit of background, and we'll see how it connects to what we're talking about this morning.
My name is Pai Patel. I have been in a shipwreck. I am on a lifeboat alone with the tiger. Please send help. God, I give myself to you. I am your vessel. Whatever comes, I want to know. Show me.
The scene opens with vast open sea. It's beautiful. But it's also threatening. He's out there with nothing. Everything he has, he's lost. Except for, of course, the tiger. The one thing that remains is something that's dangerous, that threatens to injure or kill him. This morning, we're going to be asking the question, what happens when everything is taken away? As most of you know, we're in the middle of a 9-month series called Epic, The Astonishing Story of God and the World. And what we're doing is telling the whole story of the Bible over the course of 9 months, beginning with creation and ending with the new creation. We've organized these 10 eras to help guide us through the story. And today finds us in the last message in the 6th era that we've called A Nation is Banished. Over the course of the last 3 weeks, we've seen God's people in decline. We've seen things getting worse and worse. 2 weeks ago, we saw the Assyrians conquer the northern kingdom of Israel. Last week, we saw the Babylonians conquer the southern kingdom of Judah. And this morning, we see God's people living in a place that isn't their home. This period of time is usually referred to as the exile. For about 70 years, God's people lived in a foreign land, displaced from their home under foreign rulers. For them, the land had signified everything for them. It was one of the first things that God promised his people. So when it was taken away, it was as if they lost all sense of who they were. These were dark days for God's people. Today we see the people in exile. And so we get to our question, what happens when everything is taken away? Our young friend Pai, in the midst of nothingness, when everything was taken away, he looked up. What else could he have done? That's all that remained to him. And what we're going to find this morning is that God's people, in the midst of these dark days, learned some lessons. This time becomes an opportunity for them to encounter God in a new way, to experience something they hadn't quite experienced before. The prophets helped God's people to do this during this time. They spoke forth what was true. And this morning we're going to do a bit of a tour of three prophets to see what they said to God's people during this time. We're going to start with Ezekiel, then look at Daniel, and finish with Jeremiah. Along with Isaiah, these three prophets are some of the longest prophets in the Old Testament. Each of their books is a masterpiece, rich with theology and story. So we're going to cover all of them in about the next 30 minutes. It's a little bit ambitious, but at the same time, doing it like this allows us to see some things about what these people said together, to compare them and take them as a unit. And what we're going to see is that what God's people learned in exile is an important thing for us to learn in our season. And in fact, this period of God's people's history is similar to the time that we live in. They had been promised something, and yet they lived outside of that promised land. And the way we are described as believers in Jesus Christ in the New Testament is actually similar. Listen to 1 Peter 2:11. We're described as aliens and strangers in the world. The author of Hebrews reinforces this. In chapter 13, verse 14, he says, "Here we do not have an enduring city, but we are looking for the city that is to come." And so this period of time for us is a kind of exile. And we, like God's people in this season, are waiting for something else, waiting to return home. So just as the exile is an opportunity for them to learn something, our lives now become an opportunity for us to learn something about God, about who he is, and how he speaks to us in the midst of the world we live in. I'm going to start by looking at the prophet Ezekiel. Now, Ezekiel was a priest. He was married. He served in the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem. He was one of the first people to be carried away to Babylon and one of the first deportations from Jerusalem. Imagine being a priest in Babylon. What does a priest do without a temple? Ezekiel becomes a prophet in the land of exiles. He speaks forth God's word instead of ministering in God's temple. And his book opens with this incredible, vast vision of God. We're going to start by reading Ezekiel 1, verses 1 to 9. It's Ezekiel 1, starting in verse 1. "In the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day, while I was among the exiles by the Kebar River, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, by the Kebar River in the land of the Babylonians. There the hand of the Lord was upon him. I looked, and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was that of a man, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, their feet were like those of a calf, and gleamed like burnished bronze. Under the wings, on their four sides, they had the hands of a man. All four of them had faces and wings, and their wings touched one another. Each one went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved." This passage opens as Ezekiel is among the exiles by the Kebar River. Some people have suggested that this river was used by King Nebuchadnezzar as a canal to travel throughout his kingdom, and that he employed exiles in the process of digging it out and making it suitable for transportation. And so what you have here is a priest of God who used to serve in the temple, who's been displaced from there to dig out a canal for the king of Babylon who recently destroyed the temple of God. Things went really downhill for Ezekiel. This was about as bad as it gets. But in these circumstances, God shows up. The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel. God made himself known to this man in Babylon. And he gives him this vision, this fascinating vision, full of things that are at once familiar and strange. There are these creatures with faces and hands and eyes and feet, and yet they're all a jumble. What Ezekiel sees is the glory of God. He sees God revealing himself, revealing what is to come, revealing what is true. And one of the first things Ezekiel realizes through these visions that he receives is that what he's experiencing, the things that he's going through, are not all that there is. God appears to him and he shows him that there is another reality out there apart from the reality that he's most aware of. I remember when our children were very young. We had 3 children within 3 years. They were all in diapers. And those years, honestly, are mostly a blur. We're up every night helping out kids, changing diapers, feeding, taking care. And I remember that we'd have friends at the time with older kids, and they would tell us, it gets better. And we would say, I don't believe you. I can't imagine anything but what we're experiencing. Now, our kids are older. They're all in elementary school, and actually, it's gotten better. The needs are still there. They're just different, less physical, and they don't occur at 3 in the morning as often, which is a great relief. But in the midst of that season, it seemed like nothing else could be. That was all I knew. It was all I understood I could have known. And I think that's true for a lot of us, that whatever it is we're going through, whether it's bad or good, feels like the only thing there is. Our experiences convince us that that is everything that's out there. For the exiles, Ezekiel's vision reminds them that there is something else, that there is something other than what they're going through right now. And we need the same reminder in our lives, to know that there is another reality, there is a spiritual kingdom, there is another realm. We need to know that what is our experience isn't all there is. We need to remember to look for something else. When you're in exile, when everything you have, when all that you thought defined you has been taken away, this is easy to do because it's all you can do. You yearn for something else, something other than what you're experiencing. And you become open to God because of that longing. But we can experience the same thing. Think of it this way. All of the desires we have point us to something that fulfills those desires. So I'm hungry, and there exists food to satiate my hunger. I'm thirsty and I drink water to satiate that thirst. I have a desire for sexual intimacy and there is sexual intimacy. I'm lonely and that points me to the community to fulfill my need to be with people. Everything I want points me to something, but then when those things that fulfill that desire are gone, when they're taken away, that desire remains and that longing continues to point. And it points me out towards something else. Helps me to be aware that there is something else out there that I am in need of. This is the reason behind spiritual disciplines that take something away. Some spiritual disciplines add something to your life, like prayer and worship. Other spiritual disciplines take something away, like fasting or solitude. And part of the reason for that is because when we take away those things that normally meet our desires, we're left with the desire alone, and it points us to something else. What is it that you're experiencing right now? Does it seem like the only thing that is? Maybe it's good. Maybe you're experiencing financial success, or school's going well, or relationships are really coming together, or your life is finally stable. Maybe it's hard. Financial difficulty, you've lost a job, or health problems, or you're having conflict with the people in your life. But whether it's good or bad, what you're going through now can seem like all there is. Does it seem that way to you? Does your experience seem so real, so pressing, that the things of God seem far away and distant? That's the danger of the world that we live in. So we need to be reminded that there is something else. And when we look for it, when we open ourselves up to it, it is there. When we ask God and invite Him in, He reveals Himself to us as He did for Ezekiel. God's reality is sometimes hard to see, but it's always there when we look for it. Look for something else. We started with Ezekiel, and now that you're experts on the book of Ezekiel, we're going to move on, and we're going to talk a little bit about Daniel. Now, Daniel's experience was actually very different from Ezekiel. Ezekiel was a priest in Jerusalem. He had a good life back in Jerusalem, and things got terrible for him in exile. But Daniel, when he was in Jerusalem, he was a smart kid with a lot of promise, but he was living in Hicksville. He was in a backcountry country that had nothing going for it, that was about to be wiped out. He had no prospects. But when the exile happens, he gets shipped off to Babylon and enrolled in the executive training program for the king. This is a huge opportunity for Daniel. And what we see for him is that this opportunity means that he keeps rising and rising in the ranks of the leaders of Babylon. And the question for Daniel is whether he will maintain his worship of Yahweh in the midst of such success. Will he still be a Jew in Babylon? Or will he become wholeheartedly a Babylonian? The inspiring answer throughout the book is no. Daniel will not succumb to the pressures of Babylon. He will hold firm to worship of Yahweh. And we're going to look at one story this morning that demonstrates that. At this point, Daniel had become one of the three highest people in the land, second in command only to King Darius of Babylon. But some people in the realm didn't like the fact that a foreigner had risen so high, so they decide to bring Daniel down. They talk to the king and get the king to agree to make a law that no one can worship any god except for the king, knowing that Daniel will violate that law. And he does. As is his custom, he prays to God three times every day. His enemies catch him, bring him before the king, and the king, even though he's sympathetic to Daniel, is forced to sentence him to death. This is how that story plays out. Here's Daniel 6, 16 to 23. So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I done any wrong before you, O king." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. Now, Daniel had it made in Babylon. He had the best thing going. He couldn't have gotten any higher. But he was stuck between these two powers, the power of the king of Babylon on one hand and the power of the God of Israel on the other. And inevitably, those powers at some point were going to conflict. And when he did, the question is, which power will Daniel choose? Everything in his experience would lead him to believe that the power of the king of Babylon is greater. That king had destroyed Jerusalem. That king had destroyed the temple. It seemed that that king was responsible for all the success that Daniel was enjoying. But in the midst of that conflict, Daniel chooses the power of the king of Israel, the God Yahweh, at great risk to himself. Daniel trusts someone bigger than the powers of his world. And when he does that, he reminds the exiles that the powers they live under are not the only powers out there. There is a higher power. There is someone bigger. And Daniel reminds us of the same thing, that we live in a world of many powers, but there is someone bigger out there. And we are invited, along with the exile, to trust someone bigger. Our culture worships so many gods. And the gods in our culture are powerful gods. If you have a lot of money in our culture, your life can be the way you want it to be. You can eat well and dress well. You can experience really interesting things. You can socialize with really important people. Money is a powerful god in our culture. Education in our culture is another powerful god. If you are well educated, and a lot of you are, that can lead to renown, to professional success. It can lead to money. It can lead to respect. Education is a powerful god in our culture. And there are others. Professional success, personal experience, personal appearance, social connections. Our culture is filled with gods, and if these gods were the only powers that were out there, your strategy would be simple. Figure out which god you can most easily please and put all your eggs in that basket. Please that god and trust that god to make your life the way you want it. If you can make money, make money. If you can get educated, be educated. If you look good, use that to your advantage. Whatever it is, please the god that you can please most easily. Are you tempted to live that way? Or are you living that way? Figuring out which god in this culture you can make it work with and trying to work that to your advantage? Here's what we need to know. Those gods are powerful, but there is someone bigger. There is a god who's more powerful. And that god will take care of us. Better than money or education or success or any of the gods that seem to offer so much. Daniel went on to prophesy that the king of Babylon would eventually fall, that another king would rise in his place, and after him another king, and after him another king, until finally a king would come who would establish a kingdom that was eternal. And this is good news for us. Because these gods in our culture are powerful, but they are ruthless. As long as you serve them well, as long as you have money or do well in your education, you might be okay. But as soon as anything slips, you'll be eaten alive. There's no compassion. There's no care. There's only what you can offer for these gods. But the God who is more powerful, the God of Israel, Yahweh, is a God of compassion, of love, who will take care of you even when you have nothing to offer. Don't worship the gods of our culture. They won't last. It seems like they will. Nobody in Babylon could believe that Babylon could be defeated until it was defeated. Trust something bigger. Trust Yahweh. And so in times of exile, we learn that there's something else out there that we need to look to. But we also learn that the powers that we're so aware of are not the only powers that are there. We can trust someone bigger, even in the most powerful things in our world. Well, we're on a whirlwind tour of the prophets of the exile. So having covered Ezekiel and Daniel, we're going to move on to Jeremiah. Jeremiah was different than these guys. He actually started prophesying before the exile. He was a prophet of Jerusalem, and his main message that he brought to God's people was that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed. So that made him really popular with all his friends. Everybody loved Jeremiah. Not so much. So when Jerusalem was finally destroyed and most of the people were carried off into exile, Jeremiah was left behind. He stayed with the poor of the land, and eventually he went down to Egypt during the time of the exile. A lot of what he said had to do with the coming of the exile. It had to do with how God's people were to live amidst the exile, but he also spoke of the future. Listen to what Jeremiah said in Jeremiah 31, verses 31 to 34. "The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more." Jeremiah starts off by saying the time is coming. He speaks of something in the future, and this was one of the tasks that God gave his prophets, to speak of what was to come. And by the time Jerusalem was destroyed, God's people were really aware of the fact that the old way wasn't working. God had given his people a covenant in Abraham. He told them how to live, and he said, "Because of what we are agreeing here, you will become a blessing to the nations." But they weren't blessing the nations. They were being conquered by them. This old covenant had failed, not because God had failed, but because they had broken it. They had hit rock bottom, and they needed something new. That's what Jeremiah offered them. He offered them a new way to live. They had failed the old covenant, and so Jeremiah said, "God is bringing a new covenant, one that you can't break because it doesn't depend on you. It depends only on God." The exiles needed to know that there was something else. They needed to know that there was someone bigger than the powers that be, but they also needed to know that there would be something later, that they had a future. They needed hope. And that's what we need too. We might convince ourselves that our life is going okay, that things are working. But read the news. We're killing each other. We're enslaving each other. We're abusing each other. Life isn't working. We need to know that God is going to act in history, that he is going to set things right, that ultimately a time is coming where things will be different. Jeremiah tells his people, and he tells us, to expect something later. That's what we need. Expect something later. This message is really powerful when everything has fallen apart around you, when you're in the midst of nothing, when your life just has completely dropped out from beneath you. All you can do is hope for something better to come. But it's harder to hope for something better when things are okay, when life's going all right. Why bother looking forward to a time when things would be better when right now is pretty good? That's where a lot of us find ourselves. hope for Christ returning can be this distant idea that we talk about in church and we say we believe, but it doesn't mean all that much to us because our lives are all right. But for us, living at this time in history when we do, the life of faith is the life of believing that Christ will return, of waiting for that event, of knowing that something will happen in history that we will experience and that will be like unlike anything we've ever known. One of the biggest mistakes we can make is to focus on the here and now, to put all of our energy towards fixing our lives here and forget that we wait for something later. We've experienced the first part of this new covenant, but it hasn't been finished. That's what we wait for. We start off by considering a young Indian man named Pai, who had survived a shipwreck. He had to figure out what was left when everything was stripped away. And to do that, he ends up looking up at God, offering himself to God, and asking for help. And that's really similar to what the exiles do in the middle of Babylon. Everything's been taken away. But in the midst of that time, through the prophets, they learn some lessons. They learn about looking for something else. They learn about trusting someone bigger. They learn about expecting something later. Our initial question for us was, what happens when everything is taken away? And that's an important question because some of us feel like everything has been taken away. Some of us are going through painful, difficult times in our lives. But others of us aren't. Others of us have things fairly well. Maybe there are some hard things, but there are also some good things, and on balance, we couldn't describe our lives as feeling like exile. I remember as a younger Christian, I would listen to sermons about hard circumstances, and I would wonder, will my faith persist even if things get really difficult in my life? Now, I can't claim to have gone through the hardest things there are, but I've gone through some hard things, and now I find that the question I ask of myself is different. I don't worry about maintaining faith through difficult things. I ask myself, will my faith survive even as things get easier, if my life becomes stable and secure? Can my faith survive prosperity? That's what I wonder sometimes. The exile gave God's people the chance to learn some powerful lessons. But whether or not you resonate with their pain or their struggle, we need to learn those same lessons. Because we live in a world that confronts those truths with lies every day. We live in a world that tells us that this is all there is, that what you see, what you experience, what you can taste and touch is all that's out there. We live in a world that tells us that the powers of this world are the only powers that matter, that money and education and success is the only thing that will get you anywhere, and you have to worship those gods if you're going to succeed. And we live in a world that tells us that now is all we have. That you better focus on the present, that you better just enjoy the moment, because who knows what's to come. Have these ideas worked their way into your life? Do you find yourself sometimes thinking that this is all there is, that the powers of this world are all the powers that are, and that now is all you have? If you have faith in Jesus, you are not home. You are not where you belong. There is something else. There is somewhere else where you belong. There is someone else preparing a place for you, and it will come in time. God will work in history. We live in a world of lies, but we choose to believe the truth. We choose to align ourselves with the God of Israel. We remind each other of what we know to be true, and we look for God's reality as we wait for Jesus to return. When everything is stripped away, all you can do is look for something else Trust someone bigger. Expect something later. May we learn those lessons during this time of our exile. And may Jesus come back and bring us home. Come, Lord Jesus, come. Please pray with me. God, our lives are full and rich and busy and loud. And they can make the things that you proclaim to be true seem distant and far off and foggy. Help us, God, to see you, to encounter you. Whether we're going through good times or hard times, help us to know that we are not home, that there is something else, that you are preparing a place for us and that you will return. You will send your son back and bring us there. God, give us faith through your Spirit. We ask this in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.